You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS and Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Wednesday, June 29th. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the Majority Report, and we are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Today on the program, Max Blumenthal giving us an update on the flotilla that is headed towards Gaza this week. And the incredible lengths the Israeli government has gone to disparage these protesters, activists, humanitarians on this boat. We'll be talking to him. And also today on the show, more on the debt. Is there a constitutional argument that there's no such thing as a debt ceiling? Also, more from Ad Age, the consumer divide is real. How can you know? Just ask the marketers. We will get to that and more. But first, ladies and gentlemen, as this show can only exist with the help of its members and will only exist in the future with the help of future members, I want to thank Karen D. for being a member out of Tulsa, Oklahoma. Yes, Karen, and I want to thank Susan Feinberg. Susan, who is a constant Sammy Cammer streamer. Bless you, Susan. Thank you so much. An early adopter. And I want to thank the single most supportive person of this program financially. He was also, I think, the first member that we have recorded. Eric out of Brainerd, Minnesota. Want to thank you so much for your support. Literally, this show cannot exist without its members. And we'll have a tough time existing in the future without more of you becoming members. But I want to thank those who have been so supportive. And frankly, you should also thank these people. You being those who are not members, because without them, you would not hear me right now. Unless you were in my apartment, where I would probably be saying the same things just without a microphone, without a means in which to deliver to anybody. And I would be saying, in this very moment, in my apartment, oh, Chris Christie, please run. You should be president, man. Come on. More than half of New Jersey residents, as reported from a Bloomberg New Jersey poll, say that they wouldn't back Governor Chris Christie for his second term. More than half disapproving of his choices on a range of policy and personal issues, from killing a commuter tunnel to using state police helicopter to attend his son's baseball game. Teachers in New Jersey receive a far higher rating, 76%, than Governor Christie at 43%. So here's a tip to all you physically large bullies. Don't yell at other people on video or other people won't like you. In the parlance of my daughter's last stage production, I need a friend. She needs a friend. You're a big meanie, Governor Christie, and people don't like you. 58% of New Jersey residents disagreed with Christie's decision not to extend a surcharge on the state's highest earning taxpayers. Good for them. The governor was viewed unfavorably by 53% of those polled. 45% said the view of him has worsened since he took office in 2010. 45% have gone south on him. Yet, if you watch Morning Joe or listen to any of these pundits, they glorify, he's like the America's mayor, but he's a governor. I know he won't enter into the Republican primary. Basically, keeping me from one of the happiest days I would have during the primary season. The second happiest day would be the day that he would declare that he's going to run. And my first happiest day of the primary season would be that day after the New Hampshire primary, when he drops out. Those would be my two favorite days. He will deny me that pleasure. But I do really enjoy seeing him drop in the polls. And, you know, how gravity works. He's filling that poll. There you go. We'll be right back, ladies and gentlemen, with Max Blumenthal. We are back. Sam Cedar on the Majority Report. On the phone, Max Blumenthal, award-winning journalist and best-selling author and writer for the Nation Institute. He's been covering the flotilla story and is apparently you're knee-deep in a book.
I'm working on a long book project, yeah.
And can you tell us what it is, or you don't want to let the air out of the tires, as it were?
I'll let a little air out of the tires since the car is taking so long to get to the finish line. But I've spent about 8 or 9 months in the last 2 years since the election of the Lieberman-Netanyahu government inside Israel and Palestine, and I'll just be writing about that.
Now, people should know when you talk Lieberman, you're not talking Joe Lieberman. You're talking I can't pronounce his first name.
Avigdor
Lieberman, who is as close as you could get to a fascist in modern day. Well, I guess at least in Israeli politics, but you know, in the Western world, holding office, right? I mean, is that accurate?
Yeah, if you thought Joe Lieberman was bad, Avigdor is even worse. He's an open proponent of ethnic cleansing, and he's one of the most popular politicians in Israel, actually. He's the foreign minister.
It's stunning, but looking forward to that book. But let's catch us up on the flotilla. I'm going to assume that our listeners know about the first flotilla that was attempting to, I guess, you know, send ostensibly to bring aid to Gaza, but ultimately really to provide some type of publicity and protest about the state of people in Gaza. And Israel essentially killed 9 people on board of that flotilla, arguing at first that they had weapons. It turned out that they didn't, et cetera, et cetera. So tell us about the second flotilla.
Yeah, and it's really important, Sam, that you point that out, that the flotilla is a political provocation. The people on it will tell you that. It's not about bringing aid to Gaza. It's about breaking the blockade, which has systematically de-developed Gaza, driven the unemployment rate up to 47%, and kept people, basically warehoused 1.5 million people in a hellhole. And 70% of these people are already refugees whose property was taken from them in 1948. And over 50% of the residents of Gaza are children. So it is a humanitarian crisis, no matter how you slice it. And 6 boats are heading out into the Mediterranean, or attempting to. One boat has already had its propeller destroyed through sabotage. Actually, an Israeli unit, a commando unit in 2009, took credit for doing a similar act to a boat in Greece that was attempting to head to Gaza. And the American boat...
where are these 6 boats coming from? Are they coming from different locations?
They're from all over the world, and they've converged in Greece. Some of them are actually setting out into the Mediterranean as we speak. And the American boat, which contains Alice Walker, famous American author, and Hedy Epstein, an 87-year-old Holocaust survivor. Actually, the crew is over 25% Jewish, is really the biggest PR threat to Israel, and they've been doing everything they can, working overtime to discredit the crew of this boat and keep them from actually getting out in the water through various means of legal harassment.
And we should say that the Israeli government has said that they seem to have backed off this just slightly, but if there's any journalists, and my understanding is there's going to be a New York Times reporter on the American boat.
Yeah.
If there are any journalists who are engaged in who are on this boat to cover it, that they will be banned from Israel for 10 years. Now, my understanding is they backed off that a little bit, but they say that they're going to try and figure out some process in which to punish these journalists for simply covering this. Now, Israel argues that they need to stop this this flotilla, and for their own self-defense. What is the existential threat to any Israeli citizen or to Israel, the country in any way here?
There in fact is none, but they believe that they need to keep Gaza under blockade because the people of Gaza elected Hamas, which Israel considers a terrorist group and which has committed acts of terrorism against Israel. They elected them in 2006 in a legitimate election. And according to an Israeli document, which was retrieved by a human rights group called Gisha, the Israeli Defense Ministry has said that it wants to... that the blockade of Gaza is actually a means of economic warfare. That's Israel's words. Dov Weissglass, the former Israeli negotiator, said in a meeting with Israeli ministers that the blockade was a means of putting Gazans on a diet. So this is a political blockade. It's designed for the same way that our blockade of Cuba is designed, except it's much harsher. And it's to warehouse the people of Gaza because Israel doesn't know what to do with them. It doesn't want them to be part of a future Palestinian state. And it wants to destroy Hamas because Hamas will not collaborate with Israel and simply submit in the same way the Palestinian Authority has done. So that's really what the blockade is about. And they've attempted to smear the people on the flotilla by claiming the IDF is actually, the Israeli army has actually issued several reports to his friendly Israeli journalists claiming that people on the flotilla have bags of sulfur as if they're Satan. And I don't know if these bags are, you know, if Alice Walker has a bag that's the color purple, and that they're planning to kill Israeli soldiers. And this is reported on the front page of Israeli papers. And now this claim is completely falling apart. In fact, last night I was on the phone with spokespeople for the Israeli army asking if I could see the same evidence that they had supplied to these journalists. and they simply refused to show me any evidence and said, as a journalist, I have to trust the judgment of senior military officials and take them at their word. That's almost a direct quote.
They've been they've obviously been talking to a lot of American journalists, it sounds like.
Yeah, I would imagine there's a precedent for this.
Well, so one of the other things, I mean, the Israeli government really seems. I remember in the first flotilla, they created a music video, right? That was a parody of "We Are the World," but it was all sort of like anti-Palestinian propaganda. I mean, it was supposed to be like a YouTube Vietnam.
It was a YouTube hit. It was basically like some kind of musical birth of a nation racist propaganda called We Con the World, which featured various caricatures of Arabs claiming that, you know, the flotilla was actually a bunch of terrorists in disguise as peace activists. And it was produced by a woman named Caroline Glick, who's actually American or former American, who went to work in the in Netanyahu's office during his first term as prime minister and remains really close to the people around Netanyahu. And so this video was, you know, removed from YouTube eventually not because of its racist content, but because the people who wrote We Are the World filed copyright infringement claims. But, you know, we've seen each flotilla, the propaganda emanating from in or around the prime minister's office gets crazier and crazier. I mean, this year we have this gay hoax video with a actor from Tel Aviv. I mean, it was so transparent. It was such a transparent hoax, but an actor from Tel Aviv claiming in a fake video blog that he was denied the ability to travel on the flotilla because he was gay, because the flotilla organizers were cozy with Hamas, and Hamas is homophobic. And this is part of the strategy of a lot of right-wing pro-Israel groups, is to say, you know, Israel supports gay rights and Hamas doesn't, so support the blockade of Gaza.
Yeah, this video is pretty stunning, and we'll post it on majority.fm. Yeah. It is.
I mean, it's just pure comedy.
But you know, it's fascinating. The reason why I'm just so fascinated by this video is that, I mean, aside from the fact that I think it's somewhat incompetent insofar as like it was so clearly not real. I mean, they used an actor who was. I guess well-known, you told me, in Israel. And it's shot in a way that, I mean, frankly, with all due respect to my video production here, it's shot better than one of our videos. And
right.
We do it consciously. It's not, you know, theoretically, it's not a, you know, sort of like it's just a confessional into a webcam. This thing looks like it was set dressed it's shot on a beautiful camera, and but I'm fascinated at the idea that they thought they could get away with this, and maybe they even have in some respects, just to get the idea out there. But they are really going at any length, and this clearly was not for the Israeli public. This clearly was for the rest of the world. They are waging a real full-on propaganda campaign to discredit, in any manner, in any way they can, the idea that these peace activists are trying to break this blockade.
No, I mean, we saw it last year, and with their attempt to claim that Al Qaeda mercenaries were on the flotilla, and I actually managed to get the Israeli army to retract that claim by simply asking them for evidence. And I mean, if there was Al Qaeda on that boat, the U.S. would have had Predator drones bombarding it.
Right.
But they claimed that the flotilla captain, one of the captains of the flotilla, shouted, "Go back to Auschwitz," the Israeli troops. I questioned that claim and got them to issue what they called a clarification. And this year it's happening again. All their claims are falling
apart. He said,
apart.
"Go back to the bow of the boat."
Yeah. No, I mean, but this one is so unusual because, you know, I expect them, that the Israeli government, to claim that people on the flotilla are terrorists and have weapons, because, and it's really tragic that they would do that, but I expect it. They need to keep the Israeli public in fear of the outside world and in fear of the Palestinians. They need to induce total military conscription, and one of the only ways to do that is to keep the public in fear, which is, you know, why I just think the situation is really tragic. But I'm incredibly surprised that people connected to the Prime Minister's office would distribute or even produce such a bizarre video as the one we saw, this gay hoax video. I don't actually know what they're thinking. And then when Haaretz, the Israeli paper, went to the Prime Minister's office and asked, did you distribute or produce this video? They refused to deny it, which is even more idiotic because, you know, I mean, any politician knows to just deny anything stupid you do.
Right, exactly.
It's a huge story in Israel.
I can't say
now
with certitude that it was our video, I guess is basically what the Israeli government is saying there. Now, what do you make of the U.S. position here? I mean, we have Secretary of State Hillary Clinton saying that, quote, flotillas that try to provoke actions by entering into Israeli waters and creating a situation in which the Israelis have the right to defend themselves.
Yeah.
Well, hey, this isn't going into Israeli waters, is it?
Right. No, it's not. According to the terms agreed upon between the Palestinian Authority and Israel in Oslo, it is not going into Israeli territorial waters. But because of the Israeli blockade, which is illegal under the Fourth Geneva Convention, Israel has limited the territorial waters of Gaza to just 3 kilometers off the Gaza Strip and routinely shoots fishermen who go beyond that threshold. The State Department was in a briefing about this statement. Matt Lee from the Associated Press asked the spokesperson, is the Israeli blockade legal? And she was unable to answer the question. So they're basically, they've gone beyond, I think, their role as American diplomats descended into personal opinion and politics by trying to appease Israel. But beyond that, it's an incredibly dangerous statement. You have almost 40 Americans traveling in the flotilla. It's the job of the American government to protect Americans wherever they are. When the Freedom Riders went into the Deep South to challenge Jim Crow racism, and I think the flotilla is the modern incarnation of the Freedom Rides, and Alice Walker has said the same thing. Attorney General Robert F. Kennedy dispatched his special assistant, Siegenthaler, to accompany them. He had his head kicked in by a Klansman. But the federal government was trying to protect these people, even though they were creating a provocation. The State Department has done the opposite and refuses to protect its own citizens against a foreign government which is openly threatening to kill them. And I think that's sort of a dereliction of the duty of our government. And they've basically betrayed people.
It's stunning. That is one of the most stunning aspects of this, at least from an American perspective. I mean,
Yeah. You
have governments around the world basically saying to Israel, please do not shoot our citizens, our unarmed citizens on this boat. And you have the American government essentially saying, things happen. People get shot. They get shot. And if they don't get shot, we may end up finding them and putting them in prison.
Israel has the right to defend itself against 87-year-old Holocaust survivor Hedy Epstein. I mean, it's absurd. And she could have said Israel should exercise caution, put some balance in the statement. But I think Hillary Clinton took the Likud line. And then if you go online, you know, you go on Twitter, you look at right-wing blogs, they are openly calling for the killing of Americans on the flotilla. Eric Erickson from Red State openly called for the killing, the massacre of Americans. This guy was like a contributor to CNN, to John King USA on CNN.
Well, I think he's still a contributor for CNN.
He's still a contributor. He's calling for the massacre of Americans, and somehow this is okay.
Josh Trevino, right.
Yeah, former Bush speechwriter on Twitter called for the massacre of these Americans by a foreign government.
I'll read it right now. Dear IDF. That's short for Israeli Defense Force. If you end up shooting any Americans on the new Gaza flotilla, well, most Americans are cool with that, including me. And then the reporter from the New York Times, I guess, a reporter, Joseph Dana from the Nation, who apparently is going to be who's covering the flotilla.
He's on the flotilla.
He's on it.
Boat.
He said, does that include journalists? And he says, as you fairly clearly aligned yourself with the flotilla's goals, I don't care what happens to you. Is this all about domestic politics for the, I don't expect much different from these right wingers. This is the way that they roll. But is the Secretary of State, is the Obama administration, is this just about domestic politics? Is this just about appeasing some of those right wing or knee jerk Jews in Florida? That, you know, in their eyes, Israel can do no harm because they're still living in some type of, like, 1967 mindset?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think the so-called pro-Israel donors really are representative of the Jewish community in the U.S. They
right.
represent a small faction of it, but they have all the money, and they donate aggressively. Through AIPAC and through shell PACs that AIPAC creates to kind of conceal their donations. And they have a disproportionate influence on politics, especially in congressional races, especially in swing districts. In some cases, they're responsible for the majority of donations in races.
Wow.
What does Obama have to gain from issuing any kind of balanced statement about a flotilla of grassroots activists who are directly challenging Israeli policy when he's trying to hold on to Congress? He's fighting tooth and nail to hold on to the Senate and trying to get his domestic agenda passed. I mean, this is the crisis that American democracy is in, that a tiny rogue percentage of the population and a tiny percentage of the Jewish community, which isn't representative of Jews, can exercise this kind of stranglehold on at least some component of American foreign policy. I think it's George Washington's worst nightmare.
Exactly. Max Blumenthal, writer for the Nation Institute, best-selling author, and looking forward to your next book. Let's pick up the pace on this, buddy.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks for having me on and for the encouragement.
Max Blumenthal, folks, we got to take a break. We will be right back after this brief interlude. We are back. Sam Cedar on the Majority Report. That was Tom Petty with American Girl. And I think Tom Petty doesn't have a problem with me playing it because we have music licenses. But I also think he's probably not offended by my politics in the way that he is clearly offended by Michelle Bachmann's politics. The Minnesota congresswoman running for president, in between claiming that 8-year-old John Quincy Adams was a founding father at the time. He was 8 at the time of the founding of the country. He was a founding father, but, you know, back then they started young, if you know what I mean. Those guys from Massachusetts. 8, 7. And in between claiming all sorts of things that are not true and praising the hometown of a serial murderer. She's also trying to appropriate people's songs who don't want to be in any way associated with her. She walked on stage at a rally and with that song, American Girl, by Tom Petty playing, and Tom Petty's management immediately, like I think within hours, sent the Bachmann campaign a cease and desist letter. And this is not the first time Tom Petty's had to do this. In 2000, George Bush was going to campaign rallies you know, with the song I Won't Back Down. And then Tom Petty had to say, hey, douchebag, stop using my music. Because I, quote, any use by, made by you or your campaign creates either intentionally or unintentionally the impression that you and your campaign have been endorsed by Tom Petty, which is not true. There's something in the conservative mindset that needs to appropriate cultural touchstones that in no way are consistent with their politics. And we see this time and time again. Reagan using Bruce Springsteen's Born in the USA, which could not be the song itself, in addition to Bruce Springsteen saying, hey, no, you can't use that song. In addition to that, the song itself is about as 180 degrees as you can get from Ronald Reagan's rhetoric at the time. When Sarah Palin, the woman nominated to be the chief clown of the Republican, the vice president of the Republican Party, came on to stage at the Republican National Convention, they played Barracuda by Hart. Not only did Hart basically say, stop using our song, but you realize that song, Barracuda, is about sort of the vacuous, the completely amoral, pathological corporate mentality that surrounds, in this case, the music industry, but is probably no more captured by any single individual than maybe Sarah Palin.
If you're a conservative, the safe bet is to just go with a Ted Nugent song.
Exactly. That's it. That's all you get. McCain used Jackson Brown's Running on Empty. They had to, I think Jackson Brown sued him. They had to settle out of court. The last one was Charlie Crist using the Talking Heads. You can see his video, like, apologize. I'm really sorry. I've never done it again. It is unbelievable. It is unbelievable. Well, I think conservatives should just go back and get that Bush Was Right song and play that over and over again. How did it go? Bush was right. I don't know where that band is today, but I suspect it is somewhere where someone is saying, hey, Table 5 needs some more silverware.
I think they're doing management for that Herman Cain train song.
Exactly. Unbelievable. So on the debt, Paul Krugman writes yesterday that the reiterates the story that we talked about yesterday, that the Republicans walked away from the debt ceiling negotiations because they refused to have hedge managers pay actual income tax as opposed to capital gains tax. They didn't want to disallow the deductions for private corporate jets. They didn't want to end the subsidies to oil and gas companies that are making record profits. And they didn't want to provide a limit on itemized deductions to essentially millionaires. Krugman says Obama cannot, must not concede here. If he does. Now remember, the Democrats have already given away the store in terms of cuts. And we'll get to that in a moment. Just how effed up that is. But Krugman says Obama cannot, must not concede here. If he does, he's signaling that the GOP can extract even the most outrageous demands. He's setting himself up for endless blackmail. A line has to be drawn somewhere. It should have been drawn last fall, but to concede now would effectively mean the end of his presidency. I actually disagree with Krugman here, in the sense that if he concedes now, we know that his presidency ended some time ago. If he does not have the ability to hold the line here, we know that his presidency ended some time ago. What is it that he's negotiating? What is it that he's negotiating? Would, if the Republicans came in and said, okay, we're going to cut $5 trillion worth out of the budget. We're going to scrap Medicare. How much worse would the economy be? I guess it would be worse than if we cut $2 trillion. But I would argue that that $2 trillion cut is actually just going to provide for a slow, you know, frog boiling type of situation, right? You don't realize that the frog doesn't realize that he's boiling until he's dead. Whereas at this point, you know, drastic cuts, maybe the frog wakes up a little quicker and does something about it. I will, I am open to the argument that that's not the case. But I actually think that it would be better for the future of this country and better for the economy. Not just in the long run, but in the midterm. If Democrats could actually articulate what needs to happen in terms of this economy, rather than capitulating on the rhetorical front and mitigate it ever so slightly. Because this is just going to keep happening over and over and over again because the American public is being denied the reality of the situation. And example number one. From the story back on June 22nd, via Digby, I think I read the story that time, but it bears repeating. From the Lookout, Yahoo, Zach Roth. Another poll has found that Americans are deeply pessimistic about the current state of the economy. This is back on June 22nd. But another result from the Bloomberg poll suggests a fair amount of public confusion about how to turn things around. 55% of respondents said cuts in government spending and taxes would be more effective at creating jobs than maintaining or increasing government spending. 55% of respondents said cuts in government spending and taxes would be more effective at creating jobs than maintaining or increasing government spending. The question is confusingly formulated because economists usually think of tax cuts and spending increases as part of the same stimulus-based approach, not as opposing approaches. But at root, the results appear to indicate that most Americans think cutting spending, not increasing it, is more likely to create jobs. But that's almost the opposite of what most experts on both sides of the political divide believe. In other words, this is essentially 55% of Americans say that it is more likely that at 12 in the afternoon, it is dark out than the sun is shining. If you cut government spending at a time when the private sector is unable or unwilling to create jobs, you will contract the economy, period. That is physics. That is pure physics. But 55% of Americans now say that if I drop this pen, it will float to the ceiling. That wouldn't square with the way we normally think about economic activity in a depressed economy, says Andrew Samwick, a former chief economist on President Bush's Council of Economic Advisors. When the economy suffers from a lack of demand as it does now, Samwick explained, most economists think increasing spending is the more effective way to generate that demand and get things moving again. He's saying more effective than even tax cuts. Why has the opposite view begun to take hold? In part, Samwick argued, it's thanks to the effort of congressional Republicans. Well, it's not just thanks to the effort of congressional Republicans, because there has been no pushback by Democrats. None. Zero. None. Bernie Sanders is an independent. Case in point, I was on Dylan Radigan's program on Monday. Representative John Larson, Democrat from the House Ways and Means Committee. That's the Tax and Spend Committee. The Tax and Budget Committee, essentially. He's on talking about the debt deal. He's trying to make it that it's the Republicans' problem, that they're walking away from the negotiations because it's all a process argument. Republicans are just bad faith actors. There's no ideology. There's no reality here. We want to get to an agreement that it is dark at noontime. But the Republicans are showing up late to the meetings. So I ask him, and you can hear him, he comes in a little bit, we're talking about how President Obama's going to fight for us, blah, 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 blah. And he's being a little slippery on this whole cuts thing and this whole deficit thing. And so I ask him, how is it that you can cut government and increase the and create growth at this time? His answer is so effing convoluted, you need to look no further than what the problem is. Yes, Republicans are bad actors. I think they're purposely trying to tank the economy. But someone's got to stand up to them and create another narrative for the press, because the press can't keep writing stories. The public doesn't know what they're talking about. They can't keep writing stories saying that economists disagree. There has to be some political organization, let's say a political party or a president, who comes out and makes the opposite case, even if they lose. Because if they don't make that case, there's nowhere to go after that.
We support this president, and he's got a very difficult and frustrating job. He's trying to steer a course in the middle. He's trying to get two sides to come together on this. Yes, there is some frustration clearly in our caucus, but I commend the president. At the end of the day, this is a person you can always rely on to do the right thing.
Congressman, I appreciate your support of the president, but let me ask you, how is it that it works that we can cut government? And I agree we need to raise some revenues, and we're at an all-time low for taxes. But how is it that it works that we can cut government spending and grow the economy simultaneously? Has that ever happened?
Not to my knowledge. And certainly, obviously, there are sharp disagreements. And the president hasn't said that. I mean, the president and the vice president, quite frankly, and all the reports that we've received from both Chris Van Hollen and Jim Clyburn have indicated that Democrats have remained firm, that this is the way that we have to go forward. You're going to have to make cuts. There's no question about that. But you're also going to have raise revenue. Both should be done in a manner that grows the economy and moves the nation forward. That's the adult way to handle this. And taking your marbles and leaving the game is no way for the nation to negotiate or move forward.
Okay, you're going to have cuts. Of course. In a way that grows the economy. There is no way that cuts in government spending will grow the economy. And then he's talking about, adulthood. It's all just a process argument for them. And, Democrats aren't the only people to blame. It's that we have an incredibly stupid populace. An incredibly stupid populace. Case in point, and feel free to tweet to this guy, Wyatt Hung, WYATTHUNG on Twitter. These morons, these Breitbart fans, are telling me that if the government borrows money or taxes money, it removes it from the economy. What the F does that even mean? You know how you remove money from the economy? You take it out into the backyard and you literally burn it. Or you create some type of asset bubble, and on paper, the money's there, and then the bubble bursts, and all that's gone. When the government taxes, does it take money from the private economy? Yes. And then it reinserts it back into the economy. It doesn't go anywhere. When the government borrows money, it doesn't remove it from the economy. This moron says it means that they pay another country so the money circulates in that country, not here where we want it, if the government borrows money. This moron who jumps into this conversation doesn't even bother to Google who owns most of our debt. It is the American government in the form of the Social Security Trust Fund, American institutions, and American individuals who own the majority of our debt. Our debt is owned by foreign nationals and individuals, maybe 15, 20%. So the idea that borrowing from ourselves at historic lows somehow removes money from the economy just basically is a way of saying, I'm an idiot. It's basically, I mean, these conservatives are basically like, it's as if like, you know, two teenagers are sitting by a pool and they're talking about teenage stuff or grown-ups. They're talking about grown-up stuff. And a five-year-old overhears them and wants to get into the conversation and walks in and goes, hey, look at my weenie! Without any sense that, hey, you have no idea what we're talking about. This five-year-old comes in and goes, look at my weenie, look at my weenie, and thinks that they're joining in the conversation. But in fact, no, they're just showing their weenie, and it's because they're five. And they don't understand that they're making a fool of themselves. And you know what? For a five-year-old, that's not making a fool of yourself. It's actually quite charming. But for a grown person to jump in this way and wave his weenie around as if he knows what he's talking about, it's embarrassing. To some extent, this is what we deserve. All right, folks, we're going to go to the post show. When we do, I'm going to tell you the one little fly in the ointment. Turns out people are starting to realize that the Constitution, you know that document, that's the one that's so important to the teabaggers. The Constitution says we can't default on the debt. This whole debt ceiling thing, it's window dressing. We are not allowed to default on our debt. This is money that we have already borrowed and already spent. We have to pay it back, according to the plain language of our Constitution. We're going to talk about this in the post show, as well as other news stories. It'll be interesting to see what happens with this road. We may get our next impeachment of a Democratic president. So it's like, you know, it's like the seasons. You have a spring, you have a fall, you have a summer, you have a winter, you have an impeachment season. All right, folks, you can IM me in the post show, and we'll go right in with this constitutional argument. Catch you on the flip side.